You're listening to First Words, a podcast where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry.
Our guest today is Kelly Sue Milano, a writer, mother, and modern oracle. She is the vice president and head writer at Hex Comics, an independent comic book publisher, and the writer of A Little Different, a newsletter sharing the learnings and musings of raising a son with autism.
Kelly Sue and I met doing theater together at Fullerton College in 2003 and have remained close friends throughout countless jobs, breakups, career shifts, and life stages. We both started off pursuing acting, but it was reading her post-college blog titled Quarter Life Crisis that I knew this lady is a writer. So I would love for you to talk us through how you arrived to becoming a writer.
Okay. It's a long, winding journey, but I actually started writing before I ever did anything. I was writing stories probably at the age of 10 and 11 years old. It was a way that I really found to kind of relate with my life and what was going on for me during that time. You know, my parents divorced when I was 7, and we moved around a lot. And things were constantly changing. And so it was really easy for me to escape into a story. And so I wrote, I had those, you know, those black and white, like composition books, right? And I would just write and fill them up. And I also was reading so much, and so much of what I was reading was informing my writing. And it was really a way for me to, I feel like cope is the wrong word, but for lack of a better word, it was a way for me to cope and get myself through these really challenging times. And I had wanted to be an actor forever. So it never even occurred to me to think I was a writer. Until actually I was having dinner with you. And you said, I actually think you're meant to be a writer. And it was the first time that I thought, oh my gosh, I've been doing this my whole life. And I never thought maybe I should make a career out of it, because it's something that, you know, it just feels like oxygen. It's always been so close to me that it never felt like this is what I'm going to go and build a job out of or whatever. So, yeah, that was kind of how I got into it. It just happened.
Anyone who becomes a parent to any child will go through a real reckoning that amounts to the realization that they don't know much about anything. I found this to be doubly true as the mother of a special needs child. My journey with Jones before his diagnosis was not one that could be helped by reading a book or listening to a parenting podcast or getting advice from the moms that had gone before me. Now, after his diagnosis, I'm learning all the time about what to implement in order to best support him. But I'm also learning about myself. On a daily basis, I'm confronted with my expectations, my frustrations, and my beliefs about motherhood, children, and the world. This includes my inherent ableism. This term, ableism, is something that is largely new to me. For those unfamiliar with it, ableism refers to the way that society discriminates in favor of able-minded and able-bodied people. I had a passing awareness of what this meant, but now that it's become a real part of my life, I address it in myself and see it in others every day. These are a few examples of how it shows up for us. People who meet Jones and say things like, "He doesn't look autistic. He seems so smart," or "He must be high functioning." Folks who find his normal achievements to be inspirational, or those who overly congratulate me on, quote, how well he's doing. Comments on how often Jones moves, the way he moves, how he speaks, and of course, the judgmental stares I'll often get for, as one woman remarked, the way that I just let him run around. And finally, folks who, no matter how well-intentioned, try to teach or solve him.
So when I found out I was pregnant with Jones, this was the definition of a surprise pregnancy. Jones's dad and I had been together for a year and a half, and we had known each other that long. You know, a year and a half into a relationship, you're still sort of learning about each other and about how do we coexist together, and does this really work, you know? And I remember I had he had gone to direct a play in Washington State and was going to be gone for, you know, like 14 days or something. And I was in the house alone and had come back from this yoga class and was just feeling awful. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And so I'm like, well, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to take a pregnancy test. I'm just going to take it off the table. I don't want to have it in my mind. I know I'm not, but, and it turns out I was. And what's funny is I remember sitting there thinking, the very first thought I had was, this baby wants to be born. Because I just knew, you know, because when you have a surprise pregnancy, there's always a little bit of like, okay, I really need to think about, do I want to do this? Do I want to commit to this? And I thought a lot about it. I took a minute and I was like, okay, I'm 34 years old. By the time I would deliver, I'll be 35. And my opportunities are going to become less and less, you know, as the years go by. And this could be my last chance. But even before I did that kind of inventory, I knew, you know, this is the time I'm becoming a mom. I called Jamie, Jones's dad. And I said, I need to talk to you. And he goes, oh yeah, okay, what's up? And I said, I'm pregnant. And he said, okay, so I'm shopping for props. I didn't know that that was what you were going to say. So I am going to call you back. And it had just kind of fallen out of my mouth. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And so it was a really interesting kind of like first way to describe it, because it really just flew out of my mouth. And, you know, after that, we got onto the path to becoming parents. That moment felt like an adventure, and it has felt like an adventure every moment since.
And I'd love for you to share what took place exactly 10 years before you found out you were pregnant with Jones and that experience for you.
Yeah. So 10 years to the day prior to finding out I was pregnant, I had become pregnant for the very first time. And I was in a relationship with someone I didn't want to be in a relationship with anymore. And it was a real shock to my system, especially because at that time, you know, I had the interventions, you know, I had hormonal birth control. This was before I knew that hormonal birth control didn't work for me. And so I was so scared. And I knew right away that this was not a pregnancy that I wanted to keep. And the experience that I ended up having with that abortion was a really actually meaningful experience for me. I remember the day after thinking to myself, I'm really going to take charge of my life in an entirely new way. And it really did put me on a whole new trajectory, just the experience of terminating the pregnancy. And then the following day, I had, as part of my big plan to get my life together, I had gone to the Samuel French in the Valley when it still existed. And I was buying a bunch of plays. And this was still when I was acting. And I was walking across the street to go back to my car, which was parked illegally at the Trader Joe's. And I felt my stomach explode. And I thought, that can't be right. And what ended up happening was I had had a massive fibroid that I didn't know about. And it ruptured, which is, this doesn't happen typically. Fibroids are notoriously strong. And so what ended up happening from there is I was rushed to the hospital in Sherman Oaks. And I was operated on and they removed this fibroid. And the surgeon told me that it was because I had become pregnant. That's what caused the fibroid to die and compromise its strength so that it ruptured. And she said, you know, it would have been so detrimental to your health if you would have carried this pregnancy. You definitely wouldn't have been able to carry it to term, and it could have easily just destroyed your chances of ever getting pregnant, and you also could have died. And I almost did die that day. And she said to me, if anything had been different about the timing of any of the events today, you just wouldn't be here. So again, I was set on another trajectory after that experience. And it made me look at my life in an entirely new way. It made me look at motherhood in an entirely new way. My body, my health. I really started to take my health a little more seriously and advocate for myself. And, you know, for women, it's so important because it's so easy to just be like, oh, well, the doctor is giving me this pill, so it must work. Or, you know, not really understanding the questions that you can ask your OB. You know, I just came into deeper relationship with my body. And I know that it was because of that experience that I was able to get pregnant as easily as I did. And I am really grateful for it in hindsight. And the fact that it was literally 10 years, the 10-year anniversary, the day I found out I was pregnant, it felt like this really amazing kind of spiritual bow that was getting tied on that whole story. And I felt very much like, okay, if this was a test, I think I passed. Today, I am a mother. I am a mother to a child that I wholeheartedly chose, the baby that I was ready for and deeply wanted. And it is still the hardest, loneliest, most relentless, and thankless job in the world. A job for which there is no automatic healthcare, no easy path to childcare, and almost zero societal support. What makes it so meaningful and fulfilling in all the ways that it fulfills me is the fact that I wanted it. The fact that I'm proud of being a mother. And on many days, I need that to get me through. As a mom today, especially as a mom to an autistic child, I am exhausted beyond any comprehension, and I still owe my son all of my devotion, my attention, and all of my love and support. I owe him my best, no matter what. Regardless of disability and really anything else, children deserve parents who can give them their best, and all children deserve to be chosen and wanted. And this week, a handful of people who've never known the pain of not being able to choose, who've never carried a child or raised that child without any help, who don't even know how a woman's body works, made a choice that not only hurts women, but also hurts children. How can a woman give her best to a child when her first thoughts of motherhood are anger, resentment, and grief?
I want to ask, what was the early motherhood story that you had dreamed of prior to having a child? And then what was your reality?
Oh, what a question. I love it. Oh, man. When I had dreamed of motherhood, I had dreamed of, you know, being with my soulmate, who was probably a rock star. And, you know, we probably lived in this giant house somewhere in, you know, Hollywood or whatever. The dreams of a young woman, right? And that I was going to have all of this help and that, you know, life was going to rise up to meet me when I became a mom, that things were just going to effortlessly fall into place and it was going to feel so beautiful and I'm going to be so in love. And some of that was true. I did feel so in love and there were elements of it that were so beautiful, but, I don't think anything could have prepared me for those early months of new motherhood and what it was actually like. What I experienced was, oh, I'm in charge of all of this. It's just me. Even when I would have help, it didn't even feel like help because I just felt this overwhelming weight of responsibility. And I remember in those first early days, Jones was born via C-section, so I had to be in the hospital for 4 days. And I remember being in the hospital thinking, I can't wait to get home. I can't wait to be back in my space and find something that feels familiar that I can hold on to because everything was just so new. And I really wanted to have an experience of having a baby and having this child handed to me and like naturally knowing what to do. And in a lot of ways, I just didn't. I kept waiting for like, okay, I'm going to naturally know how to breastfeed and I'm just going to naturally know how to hold my baby and put him to sleep. And those things didn't come online the way I thought that they would. And there was some sadness. I definitely struggled with postpartum depression immediately after Jones was born. I was plagued by these thoughts, like maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I wasn't supposed to be a mom. Maybe I'm not meant for this. Maybe I'm not going to be able to rise to this occasion. And those, you know, so easily can spiral out into all kinds of you know, feelings and fear. But I had been working closely with my therapist all through that time, and she helped me to get on the right medication, which put me on track. And, you know, once we pulled out of those first 3 months, that was when I was like, now it's really starting to feel the way I thought it would. You know, I wake up in the morning and see my baby and smile, and yes, I'm exhausted, and yes, this is insane. And, you know, I think that Jamie and I started to feel the lack of foundation that's really required for partners when you have a child. That was really the beginning of us starting to see the instability there. And that was a challenge, but it was really, it really just felt like falling in love every day.
Everyone had sort of told you, just hang on, just get through the first year, and then you can go out in the world and engage, and it'll become so much more open for you. And then what happened 9 months after Jones was born?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so 9 months after Jones is born, we go into lockdown in Los Angeles. And I had COVID at the very beginning. I had alpha COVID before, you know, we even really knew the, what all of the symptoms were. So I'm sitting here thinking I have terrible sinusitis, and that's why I can't smell anything. And we're realizing in real time that this is a symptom of COVID. So then I'm terrified because I've already infected my child for sure. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, am I going to give my 9-month-old this mysterious disease that's like wiping out the planet? And he never got sick, thank goodness. But it was crushing. I was so heartbroken because they do tell you that. You just get through the first 3 months. Just wait till you get to 6 months. And then, oh, wow, once they're a year, like the world opens up, and exactly what you said. And that was just the opposite of the experience that we had. And not only that, I'm not only quarantined with my infant, but quarantined with my partner. And it was like a pressure cooker experience on top of already being so afraid, because in those early days of the pandemic and of quarantine in LA, we didn't know what was going on. We had no idea. We couldn't get information anywhere. You just had to sit tight. For me at that time, being somebody who wants to control and wants to manage and is totally recovering from, you know, the disease of control, I was really not well. And then I was also dealing with long hauler, COVID long hauler symptoms. And then paired with my son moving from being an infant to a toddler, and then I had to leave my job because I couldn't function. My brain was melting down. And looking back, you know, I don't have enough space from that time to be able to say, here's what I took from it. I don't know yet. It's still so close. But I do know that I had the opportunity to see, I think that I might be able to handle anything. And I know I can walk away from it with at least that. And I also felt an unspoken solidarity with all the other mamas who were experiencing that, because that's a once in a lifetime kind of thing for a group of people to experience at the same time.
And so through all of this and lots of ups and downs, how has your writing and creative process changed since becoming a mother?
It's interesting. The writing was the one constant through all of that. Even if it was just journaling, I was still showing up to write, even if it was just for myself. And there were periods of time where I wasn't doing any writing at all. I definitely don't want to give the impression that it was like, yep, my relationship to writing was perfect and I showed up every day and it was great. No. What it did give me is a little bit more resilience around my creative process. I rededicated myself to my work because I was forced to. It became so much more about like, not about like, am I finishing something? But if I showed up and I wrote for 15 minutes today, that's a win. I would have never looked at writing that way in the past. That would have been, you know, I was so like, this needs to get finished in this amount of time. I was priding myself on working really fast. And I would have never written in small increments like that and walked away thinking, wow, I'm really proud of myself. So having that was so huge. And also I, you know, spent so many years working on Hex 11, which is the comic book that I write, but I was finding so many different pockets of creativity within myself and within my experience. And I would just write 15 pages of a script because I had this amazing idea and it didn't matter if I finished it. It didn't matter if it turned into something that I was even showing anybody. So for the first time in a really long time, I was writing for myself again. Even though I wanted to, I think we all went through this with the pandemic where, you know, we're at home, we have all this time. I'm going to do all the things that I never have the opportunity to do. And I still look back and think, wow, I really wish I would have finished that pilot, or I wish I would have, you know, finished this story. But at the time, it didn't matter. And carrying that through has just been a massive gift, because even when it is something that I have to write that's got a deadline, there's still a little bit of that. I can find the ways to do this for me. And I don't know that I would have gotten there without that extreme limitation of having this, having my, you know, having my kid and being sick and being stuck in the house. I don't think I would have ever gotten there. So I'm really grateful for that.
You started writing about raising a son with autism and what you're learning through the experience. I'd love to hear when you first started to become aware of his special needs and where you are at now in that journey.
Oh, absolutely. So right around the time that the pandemic happened, right around the time that we were going into quarantine, Jones was about 8 months old when we were noticing that he was showing no interest in crawling, or he wasn't able to push up, or he didn't want to do any of that. He could sit up on his own, but he had to be helped into that position. And so at the beginning, we had thought, you know, he was Frank Breech for a majority of my pregnancy, which means, you know, he's head up. So his head is in my ribs and his feet are folded up to his ears. And we had just always thought, you know, maybe there's some hip strength that didn't come online yet. So we started seeing a movement therapist. And then as we were progressing with the movement, we kept thinking, okay, as the physical leaps start happening, you know, they say that's how the verbal leaps start happening. Like once they get up their feet under them, then they can start talking. And none of those things were happening. Once we got crawling going, Jones crawled for a really long time, but there was no pulling up. There was no cruising. And there were still no words. So at around 18 months, our pediatrician said, it's probably time to reach out to the regional center to just start looking into speech therapy and getting him evaluated. This, now we're full blown into the pandemic. So at this time, they're thinking the kiddos aren't socializing, so they may need some extra help. So we go and we do that. And every step of the way, there was a new sort of benchmark. So once this happens, then this is probably going to follow. And repeatedly, we weren't meeting those benchmarks. And this is has nothing to do with the care that we were getting at the regional center. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. And then finally, we had moved from Los Angeles to Orange County to be closer to family. And he was in an amazing clinic that we got him into once we connected with the regional center in Orange County. And his speech therapist approached me. This is right around the time, just a couple months before he turned three. And she said, he's not really showing a lot of interest in playing with other kids. And he's also not progressing with speech the way that we would want to see after 6 months here. I would encourage you to get him assessed for autism. And because he had his first IEP meeting, which is an individualized education plan, which is something that you get when you have a child who is disabled or has special needs, once they leave early intervention at three and move to go into the public school system, I really wanted to know ahead of this meeting if we had a diagnosis of autism. And so we We did the eval and the doctor was amazing, and she diagnosed him on the spot because of his difficulty transitioning from preferred tasks to non-preferred tasks, and because of his hyperfixation on things that he really loves. And so the second that she said it, it was like my whole body unwound. It was like that feeling you get when you hear something that you know is true. And I was relieved because I, as a mom, I knew the second that someone said, this early piece is off, I was like, yeah, because there's something more, there's something unique going on here. And so for the first week, I was just, I didn't have time to process. And then after that, I went through a really interesting grieving process. My experience of motherhood up until that point had been so tumultuous. I had seen, you know, my friends and their experiences, and I absolutely got snagged in the comparison game, thinking, I have this conversation with my older sister all the time where she's like, God, all you want is for your baby to just be average. Nothing exceptional, nothing outrageous. Just like, I'll have a run-of-the-mill baby, please. You know? And that just wasn't the experience I had. And I had a lot of, I had a lot of anger. I felt a lot of anger that I didn't have the early motherhood experience that I wanted to have, that I would become a new mom when the world is falling apart. You know, this dream that I had had of like, life is going to rise up to meet me when I become a mom. I'm like, wow, that is not how I feel. I feel abandoned. I was like, I was betrayed, you know, so dramatic, like Tennessee Williams level drama. But then afterwards, after I got over myself, I just started falling in love with the process of learning about how he learns and learning about how he sees the world. And it's fascinating. It has turned into one of the more just deep and rich and beautiful experiences of my entire life, learning to relate with my son and see the way that he sees things. And it's a unique challenge because he requires such a rigid routine, and he requires a lot of me. And that, you know, this is true for moms everywhere. All of our children require all of us our best. But I think that I had fallen into this space where I was like, this is my version of my best, but I actually have an even bigger best to give. And so I had to become bigger than I thought I could be to meet this sparkly, magical little boy. I mean, I'm still so early into the process of it, but what I can say at this point in the journey is that once we got this diagnosis, it was like, and I feel so emotional even talking about it, all of a sudden we're surrounded by angels, angel people, these therapists who are so wonderful and genuinely care about him and care about our family. I mean, it's such a beautiful community. And while I don't want to say like, I wish everybody could experience this, right? I do wish that every mom and every kiddo could experience the level of special attention and care. It's just such a humane way of dealing with children when they're going into elementary school. Like, let's learn about how you learn. Let's take the time and figure out how we can serve you best. Like, every child deserves this. And the fact that he is getting it when I've spent so much time being afraid of what that experience is going to be like has been, oh, I don't even have words for it. Perhaps this is a very typical experience for a new mom. I don't know. Even so, I find myself relishing it. Today, as my first full day of being on my own began to wind down, I could feel my exuberance give way to a gripping exhaustion, as if the sleep deprivation of the last 3 years finally had a chance to catch up to me.
It was too early to actually sleep, but I also have yet to decide what to do with myself. This house isn't my home without a child in it, and I don't know how to be here without him. It all feels so weird. And this is only the beginning. He'll continue to move further and further away from me as he continues to grow and as life continues to open up to him. And I guess this means I'll be taking those same steps back to myself.
I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about when you decided to start writing about Jones's diagnosis, and how did that help you start moving through the experience?
I had missed part of a huge facet of one of my favorite writing jobs was having a weekly deadline and having to write every week. I really missed the routine of that. I missed the structure of that. I missed the consistency. And so I said, I'm going to commit to writing a newsletter on Substack and just see what happens. I'll call it a little different. And it will be about my experiences parenting a neurodivergent toddler at this time in human history. And so I started, and it was so wonderful to just kind of let myself loose. And then we got Jones's diagnosis, and I didn't return to the newsletter for, I think, almost 2 months, because I was just buried. And, you know, this is something they don't tell you about parenthood, is how much paperwork is involved. Like, wow. It's constantly something I'm having to fill out and email, and then somebody calls me back and tells me I need to fix something, right? So I was doing a ton of administrative stuff and had kind of fallen off. And then I returned to it with the information around the diagnosis. And every time I share one, I get feedback from at least one person, which is already enough, right? Saying, thank you for helping me understand this in this new way, and forwarding it to other parents who are going through the evaluation and assessment process when there's a lot of fear. And I wished that I could have had something like that when we were going through even just our, you know, our introductory stuff through the regional center. It's really hard. Even though you're there to help your child, it's hard to go through these things because you just have people coming at you with standardized tests. Jones's regional center assessment was almost harder than the autism diagnosis, because I'm seeing my joyful baby playing, and then this doctor is watching him and scoring him, and then saying your, you know, 18-month-old is at a 6-month cognitive level, and nobody's there to explain to you what that means or if that's okay. And, you know, so to be able to share my experience in the hope that it can help other moms and other families going through these processes that are just so challenging, it heals something in me too. And so that was why I had kind of started writing about those experiences. And then it's morphed into just right now writing about my experiences of this stage of motherhood. And it's become just this beautiful practice that I give to myself, and I find that I'm giving it away to others as well. And that's kind of the dream with writing.
So on top of raising a child with special needs, you're also doing it as a single mom and co-parenting with Jones's father. Can you share a little bit about what that division of labor looks like and what specific challenges are coming up for you in that experience, if any?
Our realization around separating as partners was luckily really clear. It wasn't this sort of, you know, dramatic experience. And I think a big part of that was because where we are strong is that we naturally align around Jones. We naturally align as parents. And in that way, I am incredibly fortunate, because that is not always the case. That wasn't the case in my family of origin when my parents separated. So there was a really interesting gift that I was given in the separation of Jones's dad and I. You know, I hadn't worked in so long because of the pandemic. And so there was this natural division of, I am the primary caregiver and you are the primary breadwinner. And we've gotten to a point now where that division of responsibility is no longer in flow the way that we would want it to be. And so luckily I've been able to go back to work, and you know, Jones was able to go on this extended trip with his dad and actually really get a chance to spend some time with him, because a sole breadwinner of a family in the pandemic is really just focused on doing that job. And so we've made it work really well. We are still cohabitating because it is fairly new separation. So, you know, there are all of the natural challenges that you would expect in a situation like that. But again, we have a really deep respect for each other and a big respect for the role that we each play in Jones's life, and a natural understanding that he really needs both of us. And we're really, again, just so fortunate in that way. I think that I'm still going through a process of, you know, letting the dream die. The dream of the family that I would have wanted to have, the way that I wish that it would have gone. But I mean, that's just an ongoing theme from the day that I got pregnant. Like, that is sort of the headline. Like, wow, this is not what I thought was going to happen. So that's kind of the way I can describe it. And it'll be really interesting to see the me that I am in 10 years, looking back on all of this and thinking, wow, what a trip. Or I'm so happy that it happened the way that it did, even though at the time it felt like, seriously, this is how this is all unfolding. This is wild. But again, the beauty of this particular breakdown is really getting, we finally had the chance to see the best in each other. And we spent so many years not doing that. And I mean, if this is how it all had to come down for us to have this realization, I'll be grateful for it forever.
So you've explored a lot of different writing styles in your career. You've done graphic novels to personal essays and blog writing. So I'm curious now, is there a medium you're currently leaning more toward, or is there a genre you are interested in tackling that maybe you haven't yet? Kind of like, where are you landing right now?
I am challenging myself to write a 60-minute pilot. I don't want to say I went to school, because that makes it sound like bigger than the two classes that I took about writing half-hour comedy. And I just had taken so much from those two classes that was the experience that really allowed me to step into the development of Hex 11 and write, you know, now 18 issues of that book. So I'm tackling 60 Minute, and for the very first time, I'm struggling like a new writer, which feels kind of good. You know, it feels good to be like, wow, I'm really stumbling. I need to read a book. I need to take another class. I need to. And now I'm like, you know, I can't stop thinking about it. And I'm not going to be able to stop thinking about it until it's done, right? So, and it's drama, which is also new for me. So that's been a challenging and frustrating and in all the best ways experience writing that. But I had also kind of dipped my toe into horror during the pandemic, naturally. And I had so much fun. I learned that it probably wasn't for me. This isn't my, horror is not my stroke of genius, but oh my gosh, did I have so much fun doing that. Yeah, so that's where I'm headed. I'm wanting to master 60 Minute as a format. So we'll see where I'm, check back in, I don't know, 6 months, I hope.
Exciting. So some upcoming writing that you have going on is a project called Galligator that looks to unpack feminine rage. Mm-hmm. Sounds awesome. And what can you tell us about it?
I had the deep honor and privilege of someone approaching me with this idea. And it's actually my writing mentor. His name is David Walker, and he is a comic book veteran. He has written Cyborg. He's written Luke Cage, Power Man and Iron Fist, all of these incredible staples. And he said, what do you think of this? I got this idea, but I'm realizing I really need a woman to write this with me. And I said, this is so perfectly timed for me. And so we went back and forth, and we were talking about what we wanted it to be. And we settled on sort of Fleabag meets Big Mouth. story about a woman who is half woman, half alligator. And when she gets angry, she gets more gator, and she lives life trying to suppress all of these emotions because she doesn't want to scare people. She doesn't want people to think that she's a freak or that she's, you know, wild, right? And what woman doesn't relate to that, right? I certainly did. And the exploration of what this could be started out as something that was very fun. And, you know, let's write this sort of feminine manifesto in a comic book about this half alligator woman. And then the decision around Roe v. Wade came down, and it totally changed the way that we were relating to the project. And it became, yes, about feminine rage, but also about body autonomy and about learning about your body and understanding your needs in that way and having sovereignty and what happens when you don't have that. So it's added this new layer to the project that we're both really excited about. And to be able to tackle something like this in a creative way through something that is light and funny. And, you know, the comic book medium is so fantastic in this way. It's why I love it so much, that you can really, you can focus on themes that are really difficult in really magical ways. And it's my favorite thing about writing comics. So I'm so excited to A, be working with my mentor, and to be working on something as kick-ass as Galligator. It's going to be really great. Interior, a nice enough restaurant, dinner time. Gal feels a little awkward as she approaches a two-top table where a man sits alone looking at his phone. There's a small candle and a meek flower in a little vase. She's dressed beautifully in a tasteful yet body-conscious pantsuit, hoop earrings, red lips. He wears a t-shirt. She says, "Brad?" Brad does not look up from his phone. Brad looks to her and says, "No, thank you." Gal is confused as she reaches into her purse. She pulls out her phone and holds it out to him. "Brad, from Urban Match, yes? This is you?" Brad looks up. "Yes. Oh my God. Sorry. I had just run into someone else. Hi." He stands to shake her hand. We see he's wearing cargo shorts. He says to her, "Wow. Yeah, I usually overdress for these things." Brad pulls out her chair. "That's okay. You have a really beautiful body." Gal makes a face to herself, and they sit.
Okay, so we're going to do rapid fire now.
Okay.
So this is... There's like a few questions that I ask, and then the last piece is like word association.
Ooh, I love it. Okay.
It's first words.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. What were your son's first words?
Mouse.
Oh, yeah. I saw that little video.
Mm-hmm. His first word was mouse.
Aw.
Which is funny because it was not a word that, like, we weren't watching a show with a mouse. We weren't reading a book with a mouse. That was just what he wanted to say.
I love it. What was the first thing you said when you saw your son?
"Oh my God." And then a sound like, that was what I did when I first saw my son.
Sounds about right. What is the first word that comes to mind when I say indulge?
Sleep.
Routine.
Painful.
Community.
Necessary.
Authenticity.
Every day.
Dream.
Happiness.
Support.
Moms.
Wisdom.
Moms.
Nice. You've been listening to First Words. You can find out more info on this episode's guest and the show on our website, firstwordspodcast.com.
If this show resonated with you, please share it with other writer parents in your life. We're in this together. First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.